Esther. You can go to the book of Psalms and take about two left turns and you'll be in the book of Esther. On Sunday nights, we're continuing a series of seeing the theme through all of the Old Testament, which is the glory of God. And we're taking basically a book a week, as we started with Genesis, and we'll conclude with the book of Malachi. And tonight, on the last of the historical books, the book of Esther. I want you to keep your Bibles open to Esther, because more than probably any other study in this series, we will be reading a large portion of the book of Esther that doesn't need a lot of comment on it. Once it's set up and you see the historical setting, you will begin to, just from reading the text, be able to see what God has to say to us. The Holocaust, which took the lives of 6 million plus Jews during World War II, was a horror that the world must never forget. I can remember Kathy and I had the privilege of being in the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem in 1993. And I didn't really have any anticipation going to that. It was simply where they took us on the tour. But I remember when we went in there, something happened to me. It's hard really to explain. But they take you through this dark tunnel. There's just enough light that you can see where to step. And all around you, on this kind of a thing enclosing you as you walk for a long distance, there's names shined in light on the walls, name after name after name. And as you walk through, names were called out in a very somber manner, just a name. And then the next name, and the next name. And then you come to the place of the pictures, and you saw the pictures and the torture. And I remember just being overwhelmed with the magnitude of evil brought against the Jews. Unfortunately, the Nazi slaughter of the Jews and the torture of many more who weren't killed is not unique in history, nor has it ceased to exist today. In most Muslim countries today, there is an intense hatred for the Jews. And most leaders of Muslim countries in the Middle East, such as Iran, would be delighted if the whole nation of Israel was annihilated, just absolutely wiped off the face of the earth. Perhaps the main reason that the United States of America is hated by many of those same Muslim nations is because of the history of our support for the nation of Israel. In 1948, we were the first nation to recognize them as a country. Now, how do you explain this hatred? I've pointed specifically to Muslim countries, but it's not isolated to that. The Nazis weren't Muslim. And even so today, it's much broader than that. That's just where we hear the most about it. How do we explain this hatred? I mean, it's such a small nation. How do we explain it? Well, I believe it's supernatural in nature. I think it is satanically induced. I have no doubt that it is satanically induced. And so that brings the question, why is Satan so intent on destroying the Jews? Well, remember something. This is really basic. He was there in the Garden of Eden when God the Father gave the first prophecy recorded in the Bible. That very first prophecy recorded was in Genesis 3:15, when God was pronouncing the curse upon the earth and upon mankind for sin coming into the world. And he says to Satan, God says, I will put enmity, that is warfare, between you and the woman and between your offspring and her offspring. And he shall bruise your head, that is a fatal blow, and you shall bruise his heel. The seed of the woman would be harmed, but Satan would be finished. Well, Satan knows that the offspring of the seed of the woman, that's the Jews, the descendants of Abraham. And so what he did is that he set out. It's amazing to trace this through the Old Testament. He set out before the birth of the Messiah to wipe out the seed. Then later, after the covenant with David, called the Davidic covenant, that the Messiah, this seed of the woman, would be of the line of David, he set out to destroy the seed of David. And then once the cross came, as we sung about tonight, and Jesus cried out, "It is finished," and he rose from the dead, and Satan was defeated, even now, in his short time he has left before that ultimate victory is finalized and he's cast into the lake of fire, recorded in Revelation 20. Satan inspires hatred against the Jews from revenge for what God has done through one who came through the Jews, this seed of the woman. Now, it's interesting to trace how he sought to wipe out the seed of the woman. It started with famines that came that would have wiped out Jacob and his sons through whom the seed would come. And yet God used an evil act of the brothers of Joseph to send him to Egypt, brought him to a place of power so that the seed was saved. And then it's interesting that Pharaoh sought to, some 400 years later, sought to drown the Jews and to wipe out the seed. Then after the Davidic covenant, we find time after time where Satan is obviously at work. There was a wicked queen. Her name was Athaliah. And she tried to wipe out all of the seed of David. She had every descendant of David killed. Except one little infant boy who was hidden away by a godly priest, by his aunt who hid him away, and then a godly priest who raised him up. His name was Joash. And when he was just 6 or 8 years old, he became the king in the line of David. The seed of the woman continued. You can go on. I'm just kind of skipping over a whole lot. And you find that when Christ was born, Herod, King Herod, tried to kill Christ by having all of the boy babies slain. And Jesus escaped only by God sending Joseph a dream so that he took Mary and the baby and they went into Egypt. And the seed of the woman was saved. That's only a sampling. That we, the many ways we see the enemy seeking to thwart God's purposes. Now, another of those attempts to wipe out the Jews is recorded for us in the book of Esther. In this book, we meet a, for lack of a better term, a Hitler-esque character named Haman, who desired to wipe out the Jews, the seed of the woman. He didn't know that's what they were. He just hated the Jews. And from a human standpoint, it looks like he almost succeeded. And his endeavor was stopped by a woman named Esther and her guardian, the one who raised her, named Mordecai. You will not find a book anywhere, fiction, any kind of drama that's put into a screenplay and a movie is made of it, or any book throughout history, you will not find any work of literature that has more drama and more emotion than the book of Esther. But the book of Esther is not fiction. It's an accurate book historically. The people there were real, literal people in history. We have records of them in historical documents, even outside of the Bible. The characters referred to in Esther existed in the latter part of the 5th century B.C., Now, some of the Jews had gone back to Judah under Zerubbabel, and then later on a group came with Ezra, and we've studied about that as we've looked at the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. But most of the Jews, several million of them in fact, still lived in the place where they had been taken when the Babylonians took them captive back in the years between 606 B.C. and 587 B.C. And the Babylonian Empire had now been absorbed into the Persian Empire. And the king that is referenced in the book of Ezra is the king of Persia, the dominant empire on earth at that time. Now, by way of introduction, I want to just share with you at the beginning the purpose of the book of Esther, why it was written, why God included it in the Hebrew canon. And there were some people who didn't think it should be there. And I'll tell you why in a minute and why they were wrong. I believe it should be there. I obviously believe that. It's a part of God's inerrant word. And I believe that there was a threefold purpose for God putting Esther in the Bible. First, there was an historical purpose. Since the time of Esther, the Jews have celebrated a feast called Purim. Purim. And Esther gives the basis of that feast and explains what it celebrates. There's a historical purpose. Secondly, there's a doctrinal purpose. The doctrine of the providential working of God is laid out and illustrated more in the book of Esther than any other book of the Bible. You see the providential working of God behind the scenes in the book of Esther that is so clear as we look back on it. Nothing happened by chance. Nothing was just some circumstances that came about because of human decisions. God was at work. And we will see that beautiful doctrine of the providence of God. And then thirdly, there was a Christological purpose, that is, a purpose about Christ and the Messiah, because Esther, as I've already shared with you, shares how the line from which the Messiah would come was preserved from annihilation. Now, with that background, let's just jump right into the book of Esther. And we're going to begin by looking at the grave danger to the Jews in chapters 1 through 4. Now, to better understand these chapters, let's identify the historical setting and kind of set it up. The king of Persia, well, it's a little confusing because sometimes he's referred to as Ahasuerus. And sometimes he's referred to as Xerxes. So the question is, what was his name? Well, Ahasuerus, we know now from historical documents, was a title. It was sort of like the Pharaoh. That's not referring to a specific king of Egypt. That was the title of Egyptian kings. They were the pharaohs. And even so, that was the title of the Persian kings. Xerxes was actually the king's name. We know from history that he was the son of Darius the Great, and he ruled the Persian Empire from 486 until 465 B.C. Now, let's look at the vices of Xerxes in chapter 1. And let me just begin by reading the first four verses. Now, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus, that is, the king, who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. It was a huge empire. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast of all of his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. Now, here's what was going on in Persian history. History tells us that Xerxes held this meeting of all of his leaders to plan for his invasion of Greece. And that's well documented in history. This gathering lasted 180 days as they planned and strategized as to what they were going to do. And then it concluded with a giant party that lasted for 7 whole days. That was quite a party. The custom of the Persians was that the women held a separate banquet from the men. And so after Xerxes and all of his cronies, his buddies, after they had drunk freely, just to put it kindly, of the wine, he had a wine-induced idea. Listen to verses 10 and 11. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, and some other guys, the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. The very name Vashti literally means beautiful woman in Persian, in their language. Now, it's doubtful that Vashti was asked to do anything immoral, but for her it was degrading to be paraded before the ogling eyes of her husband's drunken buddies. And so here was the answer she sent back in verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious and his anger burned within him. Now, this is hard for us to understand But in those days, the kings over empires were treated like gods. Nobody said no to the king of Persia. But Vashti did. And that caused a real dilemma for Xerxes. How could he persuade the princes and the nobles that he could keep Greece in line when he couldn't keep his own wife in line? And so the king sought advice from the, quote, wise men. Verse 16. And Memucan answered before king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all the women so that they'll despise their husbands in their eyes when they report. King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus, there will be excessive contempt and wrath. In other words, here's what they were saying. If you let the queen get by with this, none of the rest of us are going to have a chance. That was basically what they were saying. And so the king followed his counselor's advice and he deposed Vashti and declared that she was never to come into his presence again. Now, the rulings of the Medes and Persians, I recall old people when I was younger even had a saying, say, now, this is not the law of the Medes and the Persians. Now, what do they mean by that? Maybe you've heard that old saying. Well, what that comes from history. The law of the Medes and the Persians, here's what was unique about their laws. The laws of the Medes and the Persians could never be changed. Once there was an edict, once a decision had been made, it could not be changed. It could not be undone, overdone. It was done. That was it. And so here was a king with no queen. Now, that's important to understand because it sets up chapter 2 as we look at the virtues of Esther. Chapters 1 and 2 are separated by 4 years. We know that from history. The Persians had now gone to battle with Greece as planned, and it was a disaster. Xerxes' navy was destroyed at the Battle of Salamis. His army was defeated a year later at the Battle of Platae. And Xerxes came home from battle a bitter man. He came home to a home without a queen. Oh, he had a harem, but he missed his beautiful queen. Look in verse 1 of chapter 2. And after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. The implication is that he missed her. But his decree could not be undone. It was final. His counselors came to him and gave him more advice. These guys were real helps. They said, get you a new queen. Look in verses 2 through 4. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let the beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then the young woman who pleases the king, let her be queen instead of Vashti. And this thing pleased the king, and he did so. And now, at this point in the story, Esther comes into the picture. Look in the first part of verse 5. In Shushan, the citadel, where there was a Jew whose name was Mordecai, then skip down to verse 7. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that's the Hebrew name, that is Esther, the Persian name, his uncle's daughter. For she had neither father nor mother, and the young woman was lovely and beautiful, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree was heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now, don't think of this as being like kind of a beauty contest where all the women applied to be queen. That's not the language that's used here. It's likely that Esther and the other girls were forcibly taken from their homes, forcibly removed, and conscripted into the king's harem. The losers were not allowed likely to go back home, but became a permanent part of that harem. Now, Esther had been instructed by Mordecai, her He was an older cousin, but the one who had raised her as her father. She'd been instructed by Mordecai not to reveal that she was a Jew. That becomes very important later on. Keep that in mind. And so, of all the women brought before the king, Esther was chosen to be the queen. Look in chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. It says, "Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go in to the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the Christian's eunuch, the king's eunuch, had the custodian of the women advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. And Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." Now, in verses 21 through 23, I'm going to read you something that happens that seems totally out of place. It's like, why did this get stuck in with all this about choosing a queen? And I'm going to tell you later on, I'm going to refer back to this. So log this in your memory. All right. Verses 21 through 23 of chapter 2. "In those days, while Mordecai was sat within the king's gate," that means he had some kind of official position in the king's cabinet. So not his cabinet, but he had a job in the palace. "And in those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh," those just sound like bad guys just from their name, "they were doorkeepers, and they became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows, and it was written in a book, in the book of the Chronicles, in the presence of the king." Now, it seems totally out of place, but that's one of the most important things that happens in this book. Now, let's look then at the vilification of the Jews in chapter 3. And we're going to meet a man, a key character in the history of the Jews during this period. Look in verse 1. "And after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him." Ray Stedman, in his commentary on Ephesians, describes Haman this way. He was a slimy, power-hungry, Hitler-esque character named Haman the Agagite. Pretty good. Slimy, power-hungry. And he was. That's even being nice for what Haman was. An Agagite was an Amalekite, a descendant of Esau. He was from a people that God said would be at perpetual warfare with the descendants of Jacob, with the Israelites, in Exodus 17:16. Now, Haman likely hated the Jews because he was an Agagite, but then there was something that stirred up his hatred even more. Look in chapter 3, verse 2, and then verses 5 and 6. "And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage." Verse 5. "And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai." Haman hatched a plan. Undoubtedly, it was initiated by Satan. Listen to it in verse 8. "Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, 'There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from other people's, and they do not keep the king's law. Therefore, it is not fitting for a king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries.' So the king took his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, 'The money and the people are given to you. Do with them as seems good to you.'" Xerxes was known for being impulsive. And it's certainly borne out here as impulsively and immediately he bought into Haman's evil plan, which was based on lies. He didn't bother to check out the evidence. He didn't bother to look it up. He didn't bother to get other advice. He said, "Here's my signet ring. Make the document, sign it with my signet ring, and get it done." He even told Haman that he could have the money taken from the Jews who were killed. The date for this massacre that was to take place was determined, and this is important a little later on, it was determined by the casting of lots. Now, the best way I can describe the casting of lots, it was a way that ancient peoples used to discern the will of their gods. And it was sort of like throwing the dice. And the way these little sticks or rocks, different forms of it came out, they tried to discern when something was supposed to happen. So through the casting of lots, they determined a date when this would happen, but it came out, and this is the providence of God, it was almost a year later. And that gave time for Esther and Mordecai to execute a plan to save the Jews. Now, this we will see became the basis for what is called the Feast of Purim that we're going to look at in a moment. The word Purim is from the word for lots, casting lots. Now, once the king signed off on this evil scheme, remember, law of the Medes and the Persians, it could not be reversed. That was it. This meant that on the day determined by Haman's casting of the lots, the Jews would be annihilated. There would be no more Jews. And that didn't include just the Jews right there in the capital. It was in all of the kingdom. That would even include the Jews who had gone back to Judah. It would have included the people that had been brought there by Ezra and by Zerubbabel, the thousands that were back in Judah. That was a part of the kingdom. And this scheme basically said the Jews will all be killed. And any of them you kill, you can keep what they've got. You can gather stuff. And it's not against the law. We encourage you to kill them all. So there would be no Messiah who would come. There would be no millennial promises for the kingdom that would be fulfilled. Look in verse 15 of chapter 3. It says, "And the couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed." Well, let's look at the vision of Mordecai in chapter 4. Now we begin to see God at work. We begin to see His providence. When Mordecai, let me give you a little background before I read the first few verses. It seems that Esther was isolated there inside the palace. She didn't really know what was going on. And when Mordecai hears about this decree instigated by Haman, he goes into action. Look in the first three verses of chapter 4. "When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes," it was a sign of grief, "put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and cried out loud and with a loud and bitter cry. He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might go into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province where there were the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes." Well, Esther, not knowing the gravity of the situation, was sort of embarrassed, it seems, at her adoptive father's behavior. She actually sends some clothes for him to put on. Says, "What are you doing? Put on the clothes." I'm paraphrasing. Mordecai told the messenger that Esther sent to him what was going on. And he told Esther to go petition the king concerning the annihilation of the Jews. And Esther sends him back a message in verse 11. "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law: put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called into the king's presence these 30 days. He said, he hadn't even called for me in 30 days. And if you go into his presence, you're dead unless he holds out the scepter. Now, Esther is struggling here. Don't interpret that she's a coward. She's just counting the cost. And to appear before the king would likely mean her immediate death. Well, in verses 13 and 14, we see Mordecai's faith in a sovereign God. And yet, Mordecai knew that the Jews were not going to be destroyed because he knew the promises of God could not allow that to happen. And yet, he tells Esther, "We can either be the instrument of God's deliverance or you and all of your family, all of us are going to die." Now look in verses 13 and 14 of chapter 4. "And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, 'Do you think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews? For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Amen. Mordecai knew those promises would be fulfilled. He simply reminds Esther that if she refused to speak, God would have to raise up someone else, and Esther and all of her family would perish. Esther's courage from God begins to rise up, and she gives Mordecai instructions to give to the people to pray and fast for her. It doesn't use the word pray, but that's implied. To fast for, then Esther utters probably the best known words from the book of Esther in the last part of verse 16 of chapter 4. She said, "And so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Well, look at the great deliverance in chapters 5 through 10. In these next chapters, we are going to see the absolute amazing providence of God on display. And we're going to see God working behind the scenes to bring about His sovereign will. And you're going to see drama like you've never seen it before when you see these actual facts of history with God's providence at work. And these chapters need very little commentary. I'm just going to read most of them and just sort of set them up with some historical background. We look first of all at the venture of Esther in chapter 5. First of all, Esther goes to appear unannounced to the king, verses 1 and 2 of chapter 5. Now, it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house while the king sat on the royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance of the house. And so it was that when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. As we see so often, God has turned the heart of the king, like it says in Proverbs 21:1, the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord, and he turns it like rivers of water wherever he wills. Acting wisely, king asks, "What does she want?" And Esther doesn't reveal her reason for coming to the king immediately. Knowing the king's delight in food and drink, remember the guy that held the 6-7-day party and, 180 days of feasting along with planning? She invites him to a banquet he liked to eat and drink. She also tells him to invite Haman. And the king accepts the invitation. And when Haman finds out, he is delighted. Remember, nobody knows that Esther is a Jew. And so he's delighted. Now at the banquet, Xerxes, the king, asks Esther what he can do for her. And she says, "Well, here's what I'd like. I'd like for you and Haman to come back for another banquet tomorrow night." And they both say, "Whoa, this is good." And so they agree. When Haman left the banquet, just he, the king, and the queen, he was probably strutting like a peacock. And then something happened that ruined it all. Look in verse 9 of chapter 5. "So Haman went out that day joyful with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. He went home and shared with his wife how Mordecai was always raining on his parade. Mordecai was always the source of such disrespect. And his wife made a suggestion. She said, 'Hey, you're number two guy. Hang the man. Kill him. Build a gallows 75 feet high so that all of the palace and all of the city, the capital city, can see it.'" 75 feet high is a high gallows, if you hadn't thought about that. "And hang him on it." Haman thought that was the best idea he'd ever heard. He immediately went out and had the gallows start to be built. Didn't have to be all that sturdy because it wasn't going to be used, but what for a hanging? And so they built this gallows 75 feet high so all the city could see it, so that the next day he could hang Mordecai on the gallows. Well, let's look at the vengeance of Haman in chapters 6 and 7. It gets better and better. In chapter 6, we see the amazing providence of God at work. In what seems like just simple everyday things. You know, God does most of His work in simple everyday things that we don't even think of as God at work, and yet it is. that night the king couldn't sleep. Now, since there were no sleeping pills to take, the king did what students have done for history, for centuries of history, to make them go to sleep. He studied history. Okay, that's been known to put people to sleep for a long time. And actually, what he did was he asked for the chronicles, which were just simply the historical records of the kingdom, to be brought to him and have someone read them to him. He couldn't sleep. Maybe that put him to sleep. Now, it's likely that there were hundreds and hundreds of volumes of these chronicles of the daily business transacted in the kingdom. Now, if that wouldn't put you to sleep, what would? And it just so happens, that the servant, among all of those volumes, picked a certain one that God would use to save the Jews. Remember earlier in the message, back in chapter 2, verses 21 to 23, I told you there was a little section that seemed out of place, but remember it? Mordecai heard of a plot on the king's life, reported it to Esther, and it was found the plot was real, and they executed the two guys that did it, and it was recorded in the Chronicles that Mordecai had saved the king's life, basically. Well, it just so happens that was the book he took down. And so this servant is reading to the king these chronicles, and he reads about this episode where Mordecai saved the king's life. Now, Persian kings were known for richly rewarding loyalty. And Xerxes asked the servant, he said, "What was ever done for this guy, Mordecai?" And the man said, "Well, I can't find that anything was ever done." And the king says, "We're going to remedy that." Now, this is so good. Listen to what happens next. Chapter 3. I'm getting goosebumps talking about it. Let's read it. 6:3. Then the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants that attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." So the king said, "Who's in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than moi?" And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. And let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor, then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone, so that all that you have spoken." Oh, can't you see, Haman? So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning with his head covered. And when Haman told his wife Zeresh all his friends everything that had happened to him, now listen, what an encouragement they were. His wife and his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, and you will surely fall before him." And while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Now, things went from bad to worse for Haman. Look in chapter 7, beginning in verse 2. "And on the second day of the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, 'What is your petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done.' Then Queen Esther answered and said, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss.' So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, 'Who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?' And Esther said, 'The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman.'" Wow. And I think this is one of the understatements of the Bible. So Haman was terrified. before the king and the queen. And then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. And when the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king says, "Will he also assault the queen while I am in the house?" As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him on it." And so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. Wow. The providence of God. Wow. Look at the vindication of the Jews in chapter 8. In chapter 8, we find the king giving great riches and honor and authority to Mordecai. Ah, but there was still the problem of this edict about killing the Jews and confiscating all their property. Now, that edict could not be canceled. And so King Xerxes took care of the situation by allowing Mordecai to write another edict. He said, "You write another one that will somehow cancel that one out. We can't change it. We can't pull it back, but you write another one." And he let Mordecai write it. And so Mordecai basically wrote a new decree that permitted the Jews to defend themselves and to destroy anyone in the whole Persian kingdom that was an enemy of the Jews. Now, that stopped the aggression real quick. Look in verse 17 of chapter 8. And in every province in the city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. And then look at this. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because of the fear of the Jews fell upon them. From being destroyed to people saying, "I want to be one." The providence of God. Amen. Look at the victory of the Jews in chapters 9 and 10. Look what happened when the day came for the edict put out by Haman to go into effect. Chapter 9, verse 1. "Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. And on that day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. The opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them." The last part of chapter 9 deals with the instituting of the feast of Purim. And as I said, that word comes from the lots that were cast that gave them a year to get that done. And they celebrate. And really, it's more than just the lots. It became a celebration of God's deliverance from the Jews. And the book closes with a verse that would have seemed impossible earlier. Look in chapter 10, verse 3. "For Mordecai the Jew," what's this? "Was second to King Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his countrymen." One of the criticisms of the book of Esther, the reason that some said it should not even be in the canon, the collection of books for the scriptures, was that the name of God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. Go back and look. God's name is never mentioned. I would counter that by saying that God's name is not in the book, but God is all through the book. And the reason his name is not mentioned was by intent to show how God works behind the scenes. He works in the circumstances of life to bring about his plan, his will, protect his people, do his sovereign plans, fulfill them through the everyday things of life. Warren Wiersbe put it this way: "God's name is nowhere seen in this book, but God's hand is nowhere missing." Great quote. I want to close by just having you think with me, a review of what we've studied, of how we saw the providential working of God in the circumstances in Esther. And this is not an exhaustive list, but just listen. Now, I'm going to use the words "happens" or "happened" in a sarcastic manner, okay? To contrast it to the fact that it didn't just happen. It was the providence of God. Think with me. Esther happened to be chosen queen, and she happened to be Jewish. Mordecai happened to hear the plot against the king. A report of Mordecai's deed happened to be put in the book that the servant happened to pick up and happened to turn to just at the right page when Xerxes happened to have insomnia. When Haman plots his revenge against the Jews, the dice for determining the date that the Jews would be wiped out happened to be almost a year away. Proverbs 16:33 says, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Haman happens to come into the king's palace just as the king was looking for a way to honor Mordecai. And there's a whole bunch of other just happens in the book of Esther. Are you aware of the providential working of God in your life? Things are not just happening. There's no such thing as accidents. There's no such thing as luck. There's no such thing as chance circumstances. If God is sovereign, and He is, then His providential working happens through the little things. One of the signs you're maturing is you begin to recognize God's providence. He didn't bring that person into your life by chance. He brought them so you could have an impact on them. He didn't bring you to the house you live in by chance. He put you there to be His lighthouse in that neighborhood. He didn't give you the job or put you in the school that you are just by chance. He put you there for His purposes. And God is providentially working through that which we see and that which we don't see. And that's why we can joyfully obey 1 Thessalonians 5:18 that says, in everything give thanks. For this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. How can we do that? Because our sovereign God providentially is working out His plans.